The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Before I begin this Dharma talk, I want to make sure that the people behind the fireplace can hear me. Because of my laryngitis, I can't be as loud. Thank you, Bix. I see you. I see you. And also a reminder that listening to a Dharma talk is just another version of doing zazen. So this means that we sit upright and unmoving, letting the words come to us as they do. And if they touch us, then they touch us. And if they don't, then we just let them go by like wind. No need to listen with the mind of trying to learn something, even to be inspired. Just being present to these words, that's all, which is what I'm doing as I give them to you. So, continuing with case 32, the Buddha responds to an outsider. The case: an outsider asked the world-honored one, "I do not ask for the spoken. I do not ask for the unspoken." The world-honored one just sat still. The outsider praised him, saying, "The world-honored one, with his great compassion and mercy, has opened the clouds of my delusion and enabled me to enter the way." He then made bows and took his leave. Ananda asked, "What did that outsider realize to make him praise you?" The world-honored one said, "He is like the fine horse who runs even at the shadow of the whip." And Wu Men's comment: Ananda is the Buddha's disciple, but his realization is less than the outsider's. Now tell me, how do they differ, the disciple and the outsider? And Wu Men's verse: walking along the edge of a sword, running along the ridge of an iceberg, no steps, no ladders, jumping from the cliff with hands open. So I'm very grateful to David for choosing this koan. The teachers who were teaching this, Sashin, often get together and say, "What shall we do?" But sometimes one of us has an idea. And this koan is so relevant on so many levels to our practice lives, and also to the fact that today is December 8th, which is, you might say, one of the high holy days in our Zen practice, which has no holy days. Every day is a holy day. But this is the day that the Buddha, after that long night, looked up at the dawn coming and saw the morning star. If you've ever been up at dawn, you know that the morning star appears just as the little tiny bits of light come over the horizon in the east. And this star demonstrated to him all of the teachings that would later come in his career. The amazing teaching, his first teaching when he was asked to teach, was that life is inherently unsatisfactory. The great truth of dukkha, of things being not quite right. And we human beings know this in subtle ways and enormous ways. The enormity of dukkha when it happens that something terrible happens to us directly, or to our loved ones, or to our country, or to our planet. When these things happen, we call out to the universe, perhaps, at least I do this, "No, no, no, I don't want it to be this way." And this goes for everything, all the way to, "I'm feeling pretty happy right now, kind of almost a joyous, open lightness, but," and then something little creeps up, because we know that nothing stays the same. So there's that little hint of, uh-oh, what's this going to turn into? If we've lived any length of time, we know this. Things come and go, physical conditions come and go. Our loved ones come and go. This is how it is. Everything is like this. There's no exception. And 2,600 years ago, on this day, according to our legend, you know that this stuff isn't really fixed history. I was just reading a wonderful book about historians, a novel, that pretty much made the point that all history is made up. There are no facts. We just string stuff together and make up a story that says, yep, it was like that, which means that we can predict what it will be like next. But in reality, my understanding is there is no predicting. There is taking one step forward and seeing how things are. There is practicing relentlessly. There is practicing within the boundaries of our precepts, which guide us into behavior just in case we fall off to one side or the other, in case we get lost in our behavior toward other people. Wu Men talks about this in his verse commentary on this koan, walking along the edge of a sword, running along the ridge of an iceberg. It's so easy to fall off of the way and delude ourselves into thinking, no, I'm on the way. I really know what I'm doing. Yep, I came to Sesshin. Look at me. I'm really a Zen practitioner. I'm so serious about it that I would take 3 days out of my life and devote it to whatever this is, this thing we're doing, this sitting and walking and sleeping and eating. Well, isn't that what ordinary life is like too? But we corral it off to make what we call Sesshin. How lucky we are to have this technology of Zen that has been actually only operating probably for about 1,000 years and probably not in this form. Every time we do a Sesshin, those of you who are in the service positions know that we keep changing things because, well, that's not really helping. That's not really working. Let's do it this way. And on we go into the future not knowing what the next Sesshin will be like. Only knowing what we're doing right now, depending, in our case, on what has been written down by people who ran Sesshin previously. Everything is changeable. Everything is impermanent. And nothing is exactly the way we want it. Maybe just for some moments, but it doesn't last. This was the Buddha's realization. When he saw that morning star, he didn't want to teach. David talked about this. Michael talked about this. He just wanted to live his life in this great open understanding that was new to him, even though he trained for many years with many teachers, had devoted his life to understanding. What is it? What is it? What is it? And when he found it and people asked him to teach, he never stopped until his last breath. It's a kind of amazing thing that people gathered around him. This person who was an ordinary human being, although the history will tell us that he was very, very special. But Zen practice, which arose about 1,000 years after the Buddha died, man, can you imagine 1,000 years from now, what will they be saying about you? We don't know. We don't know those people. The Buddha didn't know us. But he knew something that was true for him as a human being in that moment in time in northern India where he lived and taught. And we know something in this time, in this space. We do know it. We don't have to doubt ourselves, but we do. We have to really sit upright and firm and present to what we have tasted of a life beyond right and wrong, good and bad, the spoken and the unspoken. Wu Men teases us a little bit in the commentary, his commentary, Wu Men, the 13th century Chinese teacher who collected all these koans in the Gateless Gate collection, which is Wu Men Guan, his name, which means no gate, and Guan means barrier. So the gate, the barrier, the fence, the wall, the thing that prevents us from getting through. And his name, delightfully, was No Gate. So here we are at the No Gate barrier. And he says, well, we've got this story here. Ananda is the Buddha's disciple, but he doesn't understand the Buddha's teaching. And this outsider, who, as we mentioned yesterday, is sometimes called a non-Buddhist philosopher. In reading commentaries about this koan, I found that almost every teacher's teisho on this that I could find defined the outsider in different ways. Sometimes he was a Sikh, sometimes he was a Jain, sometimes he was a Brahmin, Hindu philosopher. The meaning of the word that was used to translate to outsider just means somebody who's not working with the Buddha directly, somebody who's not, as we say now, a Buddhist. So this person wants to know, and he could ask this question in so many different ways. Is it right or is it wrong? Spoken, unspoken, good, bad, you, me, all the dualities, tell me which one it is. And the Buddha doesn't fall for that. In some of the translations of the koan, it doesn't even say the world honored one just sat still. It says the world honored one did nothing, said nothing. That's a very interesting translation. I don't know the original Chinese, but I can imagine, can't you, the Buddha sitting there, this guy comes from, he's heard about this person, he comes and he asks the question, and the Buddha just looks at him, maybe doesn't even look at him, maybe lowers his eyes as we do in Zazen, and does not respond. And somehow that non-response breaks through this outsider's ideas about opposites, about duality. But then Wu Men is not satisfied that we'll understand this, of course. So he says in his commentary, well, what do you think? How do they differ, Ananda and the outsider? What's the difference? It's clear Ananda is just a poor excuse for a human being and the outsider is fantastic. You know, we don't, that's the other duality we do. I'm such a schmuck and everybody else is wonderful. Or maybe the other way, if you're a real judgy person, you think I'm great and all those other people, oh my God. He's tempting us into the same problem that the outsider brought to him. David mentioned yesterday about the four horses that the Buddha's explaining. This was part of a sutra. I can't remember which one it was. The fine horse who runs even at the shadow of the whip. And the just to say a little bit more about these horses, because they're very relevant. When the Buddha explicates them in that sutra, he says, the fine horse is like someone who hears that in the next village, someone is dying. And just hearing that that is happening is enough to awaken them to the path. So this could be us, right? We hear about the great suffering in the world. Hakuin says clearly in the text we read today from him that there must be some amount of suffering to wake up. We have to quiver together, calm passion, with all this suffering. And we hear about bombs falling and people getting raped and murdered and disappeared. And we hear about people suffering on our very city streets. We hear about these things. And if our heart breaks at the hearing of them, then this is the doorway to the path. But then the Buddha goes on and says that the second horse is like someone who hears that someone in their own village is dying. So right here in my neighborhood, I don't know how many of you drove into Worcester and saw the beggars at the street corners. Here in the little city of Worcester. We see them in Boston, we see them in big cities, but right here, there are people living on the streets, bundled up against the cold, right now, right here. That's the second horse. The second horse needs to feel the suffering close by. And then the third horse is the person whose family member is dying. Somebody right in our own family. This is the whip coming right through the skin. This is so painful. The people that we love, that we expect to go on forever, not just people, animals, the beings that we depend on for love, for support, for meeting directly. Maybe somebody in our Sangha, maybe a teacher. I just heard that there's a wonderful teacher that I knew through the American Zen Teacher Association. I haven't read emails. He's been very, very sick. I saw one come through on my phone today that I didn't read. I suspect that he died. Somebody we know who's been close to us, somebody in our family. This is the third horse. We don't run at the shadow of the whip, just the hint of suffering. We don't run at the nearness of the whip, the nearness of suffering. It has to be right here in our family, in our circle. And then the fourth horse, who people jokingly call the worst horse. Of course, this is another schema that makes you think, oh, David said this yesterday, I want to be the best horse. I don't want to be the worst horse. But the worst horse is the one who only opens to the way when we ourselves are close to death. Then it becomes personal. Nothing's personal, but everything's personal. Every one of us is going to die. It seems far away right now, maybe to some of you, and to some others of you, I know it feels close, just because of age and physical condition. Or maybe there's actually been a diagnosis, and the end is coming. So when this happens, then we turn towards the path. And it does seem in these kinds of schemas that some are better, that some are worse. What's better? What's worse? Who's better? Who's worse? This outsider who hears the teaching and immediately, well, doesn't even hear it. There aren't any words. The Buddha didn't say anything, but he gets it so quickly. He's the best horse. He doesn't need the whip to come close and dig through his very skin all the way to the flesh and bone. He's someone who can hear it once and go off and practice it. We hope. We don't know what happened to him. He might have gone off and had a different life, married a queen and become a king and had all the life that the Buddha had previously when he was a prince. We don't know what happened to him, but according to legend, we know what happened to Ananda. And I've been thinking about Ananda quite a bit. I've been thinking about, as I said yesterday briefly, how much I love him. This guy, I don't even know, I never met him. He lived 2,600 years ago. Long time ago, many, many suns have come up. Many morning stars have shone since Ananda was walking on the planet. But what we do know about him was that he persisted. He never gave up. He didn't understand. Things were really obscure to him. He memorized everything he heard the Buddha say. He had this amazing memory and wonderful hearing. Those were his attributes. Apparently the Buddha had 10 disciples and everyone had some wonderful attribute. That was Ananda's attribute. It's all he was good for. Maybe you know that there might be some little thing that you're good for. There's another koan where somebody keeps asking the teacher, what's the thing about that? And what's the thing about this? All these philosophical questions. And the teacher responds every time, I know how to beat the drum. And he says it over and over again. Well, what about form and emptiness? I know how to beat the drum. What about silence and speaking? I know how to beat the drum. What is the thing that you know how to do? Well, I already know you're experts on being alive. Everybody in this room, maintaining aliveness. How amazing. Breath comes in, breath goes out, the heart beats, the blood goes around, all these things are happening. And here we are. good at least being alive. And maybe there's more. You know what it is. Some of you know how to beat the drum. Some of you know how to invite the bell to speak. Some of you know how to sit upright and unmoving in zazen. These are amazing things, and we need to value ourselves. Ananda knew how to hear and how to remember. And the Buddha died, and Ananda was still clueless. He knew all the words of all the sutras, all the traditional Buddhist sutras that had been presented by the Buddha during his lifetime. He heard them all, but they didn't land for him. They didn't become intimate, but he persisted. And when the Buddha gave transmission to Mahakashyapa, some of you remember that story where the Buddha held up a flower and Mahakashyapa smiled, and that was the end of that. All the other people listening to it, just like Ananda, clueless in that moment. But then we don't know what happened to them either. The way continues. It has its own energy to it. All we can do is surrender to it. And that's what Ananda did. 25 years with the Buddha, and then I don't know how many years with Mahakashyapa. And then one day, Mahakashyapa called his name. And Ananda said, "Yes." Just that moves me. How many times are you called upon and you say yes? Well, I know a lot of people in this Sangha are like this. We're full of Anandas. Ananda, yes. And it happens three times. No hesitation. No, well, I don't know about that. Yes. Not even knowing what he's saying yes to, which is an amazing thing, the great faith that we encourage everyone to have, to balance the great doubt, which is also so important, and then the great determination. Without one of those attributes, we are lost. If you just have great faith and great doubt, you're really in trouble because you just keep swinging back and forth on the seesaw. Great doubt and great determination can make you into a sort of an asshole. And great faith and great determination, a different kind of asshole. We need them all. We need them all. We need this amazing, heartful connection to the way, to the teaching that is offered. How amazing. When I think back to when I first started sitting with my first teacher, went to an evening lecture with David, we'd heard about this guy. I had no idea that I would be a teacher myself someday. In my wildest dreams, I never imagined wearing robes of a priest or shaving my head. This is like, if somebody had told me this, you know, how those in those science fiction shows where somebody comes back from the future and says, "Let me tell you what's going to happen." No, I would never have believed it. And yet, each step along the way led to an unbelievable, unpredictable place. On Thursday night, Jenny ordained as a priest. I had the privilege of ordaining her. I don't know if Jenny, when she was a little girl running around, thought, "Oh, someday I'm going to shave my head and put on these really heavy robes that are really hard to put on and try to walk and bow in them." No, no. And yet somehow all the steps led to that. This is Ananda's path. The path of Ananda is to realize the good fortune of encountering the Dharma and saying yes, using what's being offered to you. The Buddha is already awake in you, but hidden over, covered over, and our job is to settle down enough so that we wear away, or we don't even do it, the old ideas about self and other, about right and wrong, they wear away to be replaced by a different way of living, living with awakening within the precepts. It's not just do whatever you want. It's not that kind of emptiness, la, 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 nothing matters. everything matters. When we touch that truth, whatever kind of horse we are doesn't matter, but at some point we need to know that the suffering of ourselves and others is universal and it is ours. And the touch of it is ours. And we sit as the Buddha in that suffering. And then the world is revealed to us, the morning star, the taste of lentil soup, the taste of coffee, the feeling of the pillow as your head touches it as you go to sleep. All of these things are the world revealing itself. None of them are special. They're very, very ordinary. We wear these fancy robes, but that's just sort of a decoration, the decoration of something that's just very plain. And it's hard. It's hard to live this life fully, to say yes to the Dharma. And the Dharma, of course, is the way things are, the law of the universe. The word comes from a derivation from Sanskrit that means what you can hold in your hand, what you can touch. Not fancy. The Dharma sounds so fancy. It's right here, always. The book I'm holding in my hand that was written by my Zen ancestor, Robert Aitken. The robes that were sewn for me by various people that I'm wearing, these cushions, the floor, the trees. I can touch these things and I can feel the universality of them. They don't belong to me, but they offer themselves. When my foot touches the floor says, yes, just like Ananda. This is the world we live in, the Dharma offering itself to us everywhere. And in the Zen tradition, directly through teachings, through teachers. And then the great treasure of the Sangha, we chant to the three treasures, the Buddha, that's you, the Dharma, the teachings that surround us, the Sangha, the community that we get to practice in. Just like you have to have great doubt and great faith and great determination, you also have to do in this other threesome the recognition of you are the Buddha. You're the awakened one. So stop fooling around. Stop messing around. Stop creating all these stories about yourself that prevent you from seeing this. And what is the Buddha? It's just the way you are right now. You don't have to be different. That's an amazing teaching. Unbelievable. And the Dharma offering itself all the time, surrounding us with love, is another word that's sometimes used to translate Dharma these days. And then the Sangha, the community of other people who have also said yes. I'll just end one more comment on the last few words of Wu Men's verse, where he says, no steps, no steps, no ladders, jumping from the cliff with hands open. Can you do this? Can you step into the next moment without expectations? Can you enter Doksan without hiding, without putting on your mask and your costume? Can you come with empty hands to this life? An outsider asked the world, honored one, I do not ask for the spoken, I do not ask for the unspoken. The world honored one just sat still. The outsider praised him, saying, the world honored one with his great compassion and mercy has opened the clouds of my delusion and enabled me to enter the way. He then made bows and took his leave. Ananda asked, what did that outsider realize to make him praise you? The world honored one said, he's like the fine horse who runs even at the shadow of the whip. Ananda is the Buddha's disciple, but his realization is less than the outsider's. Now tell me, how do they differ, the disciple and the outsider? Walking along the edge of a sword, running along the ridge of an iceberg, no steps, no ladders, jumping from the cliff with hands open. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable. People behind the fireplace can come out. Everyone else can orient in this direction. Start with Will.
Thank you for the talk, Melissa. I guess I'd like to ask about suffering. It's not avoidable, but when you're sitting zazen, even if you've been doing it a long time, it can become extremely painful.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess, I don't know. I mean, I guess I sometimes think I can do this and I stick it out. And sometimes I think, I can't do this. I can't, this hurts too much. So I don't know. I guess I'm wondering about the relationship of that, those thoughts, those experiences to what you're talking about.
I'm just checking if anybody else has something to say.
I mean, I know you guys are free from suffering. So
oh, yeah, obviously.
Never
well, I can certainly use... I'm so proud of myself that I did not lose my voice during the talk. Now I am. Yeah, suffering. I often say that it's not about getting rid of suffering. You know, the second noble truth is to see the cause of suffering, which is wanting things to be different than the way they are. And the third one is that you can be free, but I like to say in the midst of suffering. Mm-hmm. There's a certain freedom to just suffer. You know, my sinuses are blocked, mm-hmm. and I hate it. Mm-hmm. And the hating of it mm-hmm. is also the Buddha nature arising as, I hate this, mm-hmm. right? When I feel like my leg is going to fall off because why did I sit in cross-legged posture mm-hmm. for a long Dharma talk, which happens to me quite often, then, okay, that's it, right? The no that comes up is also the Buddha nature coming. There's no escape from that, but there is this different relationship. There's like, of course I hate this. You know, I always remember, I don't know who it was, but a famous Zen master who was dying, and the last words are important. What are your last words, master? It hurts. It hurts. Mm-hmm.
So, sitting through the pain is useful.
Yeah, up to a point, right? Yeah.
So middle way, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe a chair. I think some of them our more advanced practitioners sit in chairs. They're smarter than some of the others of us. So yes, do what we can, but Sashin is designed to turn the heat up, mm-hmm. right? And designed to offer us the opportunity to approach our suffering in some new way. I mean, all of us, none of us would survive if we didn't have this automatic, I want to feel okay, I don't want to suffer. So, yeah, if you're cold, put a sweater on, you know. This is a wonderful thing. But there's something else beyond heat and cold, beyond comfort and discomfort. Mm-hmm. And since discomfort is going to come, and we can't control that, and we can't even control the degree, we can try, we can do our best, and we should be kind to ourselves and our body, but as we meet what is arising, there is some incredible possibility. And the opinion is so strong. Mm-hmm. I should not feel this, you know, I don't like it. But it is not what you think it is.
What would my orthopedist say?
Yeah, well, totally. you know, wear the shoes they recommend, and then I guarantee there will still be enough suffering to you for you to wake up.
Thank you. Yeah, Rich.
Yeah, thank you. A lot to digest, but what occurred to me when you're talking about Ananda, everybody's saying he's clueless, but obviously he's not clueless because something sparked this determination and faith, and maybe couldn't put it into words, and it's just for story, but I mean, I know for me, I probably couldn't put it into words, I mean, put into a lot of words, but I couldn't really put into words why I started practicing, but something got sparked, even if, you know, I was clueless.
That's right.
Which I was.
Yeah. I would just say clueless is not necessarily a negative term.
Right. Right, yeah, well, it comes across as negative in the...
Oh,
well,
okay.
Well, it's me, you know, I'm first hearing it.
Yeah, of course.
But obviously he's not clueless.
No, and Wumen's baiting us. You know,
right.
Oh, he didn't get it. Who's
right.
better?
Right.
This is what we think. We really prize beginner's mind,
right.
Not knowing. You know, those are the many people here who are newer to Sesshin or haven't been around for a while, trying to remember all the forms. It's so hard, right? And we can beat ourselves up,
right.
Or we can say, "Wow, I didn't remember to do that." Somebody corrects us, and we go, "Oh, right." Or you know, "Thank you," which is a nice way of doing it. But it's a process. All the horses are equal.
Right, and each one is complete.
Mm.
So cluelessness is just how it is for us human beings, and we're all clueless, and none of us. Mm. And Ananda didn't become a better person at some point.
Mm.
He was always Ananda, and each one of you are already complete. You don't have to do something else or be someone else. Because it is already here.
I was also thinking, Rich, as you spoke, that, you know, Ananda, famous for having this eidetic memory and able to recover all of these discourses that would have been lost otherwise, and had his head been filled with his own brilliant stuff, you know, there may not have been room for him to transmit the teachings to us and all beings, so... So that was his karma.
Right.
So I wouldn't want you not to be rich.
Thank you. Yeah.
But
I want
to
be somebody else.
The only thing I want is for you to want to be rich.
Right. I get it. Yeah.
It's beautiful. Thank you. Yeah. Paul M.
Yeah, I've always heard the story about horses. I feel like I'm the worst horse here. By far. And I actually don't mind it because everybody tells me what to do. Sometimes I do it, sometimes I don't. I feel like I'm not only the worst horse, but I'm the wild horse. And you guys try to domesticate me. It's going to be, and it's really the story of my life. Everybody's telling me, you got to do this, you got to do this. I grew up in a place that I hate rules. So I left that place that were a lot of rules. And I come here, you know, my wife has been married 37 years, she's still trying to domesticate me. She's very hard. I'm still 66 years old. I'm still as wild as I ever was. So I feel really at home that you guys appreciate, you know, the bad horse and the wild horse. Thank you very much.
Yeah, so no need to brag. we do give out an award at the end of Sesshin for the worst horse, and all of you are in consideration. It's a closely fought competition, all showing up as ourselves. It seems to me the longer you come, the worse mistakes you can make. So... appreciate your coming as you are, and the spirit, and this being willing to receive help. This is what we're doing here, all of us. So.
Yeah. And that non-bragging is serious. Because when we say, I am like this, and you are like that, we get really stuck in our ideas. So if you could loosen up and not present yourself in any particular way, but wonder, is that really true? Maybe not. And of course, the story of the horses has nothing to do with wildness or not. It's about meeting suffering. How do you meet suffering? Do you just hear about it and you go, yep? Or do you have to be, and I know this about you, do you have to be flayed to the bone? Right? So this is such an important teaching, Paul, to demonstrate yourself like that and then to allow us to say, that's not who you are. You are so much more than any opinion you have of yourself. And hopefully through this practice, you'll discover that. But maybe not. Yes, Eugenia.
Thank you for the document. I could identify, and I hope it doesn't sound like bragging.
It probably will.
I could identify with absolutely all characters that were mentioned in the story, but particularly cultivated compassion for the outsider in me. I have felt like I have had many new beginnings and thought about how prophets or people who have brought change, positive change, have been always stoned and being the outsiders of their community. And a lot of compassion, you mentioned the suffering our country is going through. It's a country made of outsiders. Nobody wants and they came here. Adventurers as well. I mean, they were not only outsiders.
And also, you know, again, weaving a story. and you know, Shakyamuni Buddha, Gautama Siddhartha, was the ultimate insider. He was a prince. He grew up in a palace. His father was the king. And he made himself an outsider. He left the palace, but he came from within the center of that culture. So really, all of these roles are interchangeable. And just as Melissa was suggesting a moment ago, not identifying with any of them. So tempting to be the outsider, tempting to be the worst horse, tempting to be Ananda. Mm-hmm. And what about being a person of no rank?
And I think, too, I was thinking this, that there's, some of us have an addiction to being an outsider. That's our comfort zone, you know, not me. These people are crazy. I don't want to have anything to do with it. We have these narratives in our heads. So just to watch that, to watch any self story, that they're all limiting. They're not the breadth and the space of who you actually are. Yeah. Yep. Wow. Saw so many hands. Let's go with Brad first.
Thank you, Melissa. You mentioned hiding real near the end of the Taisho, and that's sticking with me, and I'm guilty of it, I think. and it's not under my control. It feels like spontaneity helps. Planning doesn't help. And I'm just connecting it to the very last part of the verse about hands open. And I wonder what to make of that.
You have a visitor?
Is the door not latched?
The door just opened. Could you? Thank you, ma'am.
Could be the mail.
Oh, yeah, and it opened the door a little. Or it could be the wind, or it could be that ghost from last night. Yeah. Oh my God, did you hear that?
Oh. It'd be Elijah.
Yeah, I was scared. I was scared. yeah, back we go. Oh yeah, right.
so how to get up?
I think what I caught in what you were saying that I can respond to is that you're absolutely right. We are not in charge of lowering that wall. Our job is to notice that it's up, mm-hmm. and to feel the way it's penning us in. And just, you know, what is that line? Awareness is its own action, right? That so we can't do it. Just like we actually can't beat our hearts or make our immune systems function. We can't do any of that stuff. But we can be aware of what's happening. And that's the beginning of it, just to see that. And until we see it, we'll just stay in the comfort of it. I think it's comforting.
And then part of it is these places. One, it's so painful when we begin to see where the problem is.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's much nicer when the problem is out there, but see, oh my God, I am doing this mm-hmm. to myself. I am a terrible person, mm-hmm. right? And then that reinforces all of the things. So the thing that you most would like to be rid of, hiding or anxiety or anger or dullness or, you know, whatever it is for you, this is the entry gate, right? So hiding is your superpower. and as you can notice your opinion about it, it should not be, I should not be, it is this, I am that. All of these are just words. Do not judge by any standards. So what if your way in is hiding? Right? And as Melissa said, you can feel, what's it like, what's the pain? This is not just you, this is all human beings who ever lived. Mm. And your bodhisattva vow is to free all beings as they are, right? Free in the middle, not when you learn not to hide. Yeah.
Thanks, Pat.
Yeah. Thank you for the talk and for everybody's talks. This thing you just said there about, you know, here we are, great effort, right? I mean, this is not lounging on a couch and watching TV, you know, and yet there's nothing to do. And there is this suffering and this sense of, you know, whether it's physical, as Will was alluding to, and probably also alluding to mental or spiritual or, yeah. or psychic, you know, like the all the things we do. And somehow that is it too. I kept coming back this weekend to something Michael said the first night about no one is a stowaway. And we're all describing ways that we feel like stowaways. self-loathing stowaway, the hiding stowaway, the untamable stowaway, whatever. But that's a really powerful thing that you belong here.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
As you are.
Yes.
And one resists sinking, letting that sink in. It's like somehow the attachment
That's it. Except that's what I meant by the addiction.
Yeah.
You know, we're addicted to our self stories. Even when they're really mean.
Mm-hmm.
We're so mean to ourselves. I can't believe, you know, poor excuse for a Zen teacher. How dare, look at you, you're sick. You know, it just goes on and on and on. And seeing that clearly, right? That's what you're talking about. And it's painful. And yet, what's the alternative? Living in delusion. You can have a nice life. Mm.
When you were speaking about the stowaways, I got the image of in my mind of a ship where all these people are, you know, one's in a coil of rope and one's behind a bulkhead. All of them think that they're hidden and they're all totally and, you know, looking out here, I think I'm hiding.
Nobody sees me.
And that really is part of what Zen teaching is seeing nothing's hidden. And part of Zen practice is realizing that nothing's hidden, including you.
Yeah. I had the image of, you know, captain at the wheel. Yeah. I'm a stowaway, no one knows.
That's great.
And I guess I also just want to speak up for the reality of being othered. Many of us occupy statuses and come from backgrounds where people look at us and we are othered. And because of how we look, because of how we talk, because of all of these things. So this is not to say that that's not a huge deal. But to say, so I'm a cisgendered white man who's college educated, and I too often feel like an outsider. So it's not contingent upon anything, but there are factors, depending on how people perceive you, that we have to deal with every day. So I just want to acknowledge the truth of that. It's not one or the other. It is all of the above.
Right. And, yeah. And you know, these self stories have to come from somewhere. So what our life experience has been shapes them, but it limits us too. Bix.
Yeah, so thank you for what everybody's been saying. I'm so touched by this koan, and I'm especially touched by the sort of, you said yesterday, Alan, that like you have to be willing to be Ananda, like to be to be the clueless one. And I think that ties into what's touched me about this koan of somebody coming in with all these ideas about like it's this way or it's that way, like I don't, you know, and then the Buddha sort of just, in my eyes, like demonstrating like just this without any ideas. And for me, it's almost impossible to see through that, to see that message that the Buddha is trying to get across when I'm so convinced of that things are like some way and like I don't even realize that I am. And I guess, yeah, I wonder if Ananda couldn't see this because he had all these ideas about like what the Buddha, he had all of the Buddha's amazing words stuck in his head. So he couldn't yet experience like just this.
And yet he wasn't clueless. I want to go back to what Rich is saying. The Ananda was not missing anything in some way. And Bix, I know you're a musician and do other things in your life. And I know there are moments in your life where there is no doubt, where there is no problem with words or not words. And all of us are like this. All of us know what's going on here, even though some of us defend our ignorance quite vociferously. I do not know. I do, you know, and I think we're talking about all these identities, and I just really appreciate this, how all of us are showing up. All of us already know. None of us have a clue. All of the above. Yeah.
You know, just another thing I just remembered about Ananda, I think this is true, maybe you guys know different, but, you know, originally the Buddha wouldn't let women into his Sangha. Mm. And it was Ananda talked him into accepting his mother, his stepmother and his wife into the Sangha. The wife he'd abandoned back at the palace. They came after him. Said, we heard something's going on. We want to be part of it. And it was Ananda who stood up for these othered people. Anybody in the room who is not cisgendered knows what I'm talking about. It's just to be looked. Somebody I know really well walked past me the other day without even seeing me. I was just like, I'm invisible now. But at this age, I would say, as an old woman, and it's just like, what just happened. Oh, right. Because I forget about that, the limitations of that identity. Hmm. And so Ananda was also a hero to this forgotten group or this othered group, really. And in 2,600 years ago in India, I think, you know, I don't know what it was like, but I can only imagine. It's bad now, but it must have been worse then. So I think maybe that's a great place to end. Let's come back, get our zendo in order.